Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chatter. We are in a secure, undisclosed location somewhere in Northwest Washington, D.C. And in just a little bit, we are going to be talking to first-time novelist Thomas Dann about this great book, Midnight in Memphis, which I think ostensibly should be the middle name of the show. Because so often, a book will be ostensibly about XYZ, and then it's about so many other things, as is this book. But first, Claude's here doing all the important work, ably assisted by Manny. Really well assisted by Manny. David's here. He has been given dispensation early exit to go watch his beloved American
My
Eagles.
My beloved Eagles are playing at 7 p.m., yes.
And tell us again who they're playing tonight, David.
Marywood College.
Is it a girl's school?
A powerhouse.
The story is that it used to be a girl's school, but it's no longer. It's now co-ed. And they play basketball in Division III. So this is a game we should win.
Should win. Fingers crossed. Okay. And Renaissance Man About Town, Rodney Ferguson. Rodney, welcome back, man.
It's great to be here, as always.
Let's start out with the important things like the cocktails. Rodney, would you like to explain what you've crafted to go along with tonight's book?
People here are enjoying the Midnight in Memphis. Very clever name.
There you go.
For your holiday cocktail making pleasure, it's three parts bourbon, has to be below the Mason-Dixon line, none of this Hudson River stuff they sell and call it whiskey.
Oh,
this is Old Soul from Jack Cathead Distillery in Jackson, Mississippi. One part chicory liqueur, hard to find. But not impossible. And if you're here in the DMV, you can go to Schneider's Liquors on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. They've been serving a fine booze since before, during, and after Prohibition. And then a little bit of sweet vermouth and a couple of shakes of Creole bitters from Bitter Truth with a twist of lemon. There you go.
All right. Okay.
Very good. Shut that obnoxious uncle up forever with this one.
All right.
And
so,
people will be sleeping here this evening.
Buffalo Trace Bourbon. That's in Kentucky, right?
That's in Kentucky.
Is that below the Mason-Dixon?
No, they didn't declare during the Civil War, so you can't go that way.
I like Buffalo Trace.
Any bourbon will work. Any bourbon's good bourbon. So, it'll work. Anything you can find.
Is that it? Just all bourbon's good, just some is better than other bourbon?
Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you for doing this. It's wonderful. I only need
really
one.
You're more than welcome.
Only need one. Okay, a little bit of housekeeping before we turn to Tom and this great book. And that is on The Pitch, our writing contest.
Yes.
Thank you, Ron Charles, who has been tremendously helpful in connecting me with a lot of good people at different stores. But for those of you who haven't heard, we're doing this in 2026, and it's a writing contest. There are 9 million, but this one is different because the contestants in this writing contest are going to be nominated by about a dozen independent bookstores around the country. And we're trying to represent all the major regions of the country. And they're going to nominate an author that has a book out in the first half of 2026. We, the collective, we will whittle it down to 4. And we're going to have some pretty cool judges who will pick the final winner, who will get $5,000 for the prize. And the greatest thing has been over the last few weeks talking to some of these independent bookstores. And everybody has their favorites, but Exile in Bookville has signed up. Steve Israel, former Congressman Steve Israel, Washington people, remember him?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I reminded him of seeing him at Saratoga
Racetrack
20 years ago. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
He decided to get out of Congress before he said to me, I was talking to him a couple weeks ago, he goes, I realized I could only talk in sound bites and I had to get out.
Yeah.
But he's opened a bookstore on Long Island, Oyster Bay, called Theodore's Books, because Teddy Roosevelt hung out there.
Okay.
And he started a bookstore, and we've got Books and Books in Miami, which is pretty famous, and we've got several others. And so the enthusiasm from the bookstores is very, very cool. We might have to reach out to the listeners because we might miss a region or two, and we'll need some more. Okay, Rodney's here because we love Rodney. He makes great drinks, and he's related to my dear friend, Lori. And he is in a men's book club.
Indeed,
with Anki, Architect of the Stars. And is that how you met Tom?
No, I met Tom through the most you know, Washingtonian way possible, our nannies were best friends.
Yeah, just the worst.
So, when your nannies are best friends, it doesn't take you long to be best friends.
Well, that's actually the transitive property of best friendship. It started with the nannies being best friends, and then our sons Harry and Hayden became best friends, and then we became best friends, and here we are.
Here we go. Rodney used to be a real person because he used to refer to people like this as a babysitter. Only when you become a Washingtonian do you say our nanny.
Yes.
Nice.
If you know the Filipino nanny cabal, they're not babysitters. They take themselves very, very seriously.
They are definitely professionals. Yep. Okay, you and Tom can answer. We usually have a segment B. We don't have a lot of time for this evening. But there have been a lot of articles recently about men should read more fiction. And there are different theories given about why they think men should read more fiction. Rodney is a primary member of that men's book club. What do you think?
Well, Tom, the reason I'm in it is because of Tom. Tom invited me in several years ago, many years ago now. And so kudos to Tom. He is one of the OG book members. But it's really been one of the most pleasurable things in my adult life, I have to say. I enjoy it. To your point, we make a real point to alternate fiction, nonfiction. That's taken very seriously. Mm-hmm. We're on fiction this week. We were on nonfiction last week. And so it's great because you get a balance of those people that like rip-roaring history stories. We get those in periodically. Mm-hmm. But then we read things that are really contemplative, and we also break out of the sort of men's fiction. You know, it's not all about guys hunting and fishing, even though we do some of that.
There is some of that.
Yeah. But is it Burning Man? That's great.
Yeah. There's even been the occasional dip into chick lit.
Nice. Do you remember which titles?
Tom, do you remember the one that we read that was not universally loved, but nonetheless,
it wasn't 50 Shades of Grey.
I know that. No, it wasn't that.
Yeah, if it wasn't universally loved, I wiped it from my memory.
it'll occur to me in the middle of Tom's wonderful presentation. I'll blurt it out.
But, okay, Tom. Before we get to your fabulous book, Midnight in Memphis, and before I pass out from this drink,
or me.
Yeah. What's the routine at the men's book club?
Okay, I think this is the ideal setup for a book club. We show up at 8. Everybody's already had dinner. Nobody's having to do a dinner party, right?
Perfect.
It's just booze and nibbles and books. That's it.
And
it's like
food,
it's like 8 to 10. 8 to 10, and then if we want, we keep going after that. But it's it makes it very. I have to tell you, it makes it very easy to be the host.
Right.
Because you're not having to like plan things a week ahead of time and clean your house and all this other stuff. Well, you're not going to clean your house for a guy's book club anyway.
No, you're not. You're going to clutter it, actually.
Does somebody lead a discussion or do you just start yakking?
We just start yakking and we kind of, cover the entire range of topics that you could imagine, including the book. And then the most recent thing that we've interjected is that we read a poem. Once you've exhausted the book topic,
David and I are out.
A little short topic like a poem is perfect.
Yep.
Do you have a favorite poem?
No, I don't. I just like to, you bring something that kind of stimulates the conversation, like a villanelle that people can kind of ponder.
Awesome. Okay, we love backstories here, Tom. And before we talk about Midnight in Memphis, do you know the rule, by the way? It's like, It's a Wonderful Life. Every time a bell rings, an angel gets swings. Every time on a podcast you name the title of the book, there's a sale. So we try to say it very often, Midnight in Memphis. Mm-hmm. We sold a lot of D. Smith's books the other night.
God bless us all, everyone.
He needed it. He needed it. So we've had a lot of lawyers turned authors. We've had a lot of people who've turned from one profession to another. And you, five generations Memphis?
Yeah.
Okay, but you've got local ties, too, including right down the block from where we are.
That's right, yeah.
Tell us where you came from.
Five generations ties to Memphis, but my family actually came from Georgetown and moved to Memphis. So that shows you how far back it goes. If you go down to M Street, the City Tavern there, you'll see a sign of the Indian King hanging out in front of the City Tavern. That was our tavern.
So great.
Yeah. So
did they sell everything?
What do you mean?
All kinds of booze?
I have no idea. I know they sold their own booze. What's the Old Yanisey?
That's
Old
it, Rodney. Yanisey. What's that one?
Well, Old Yanisey is an extinct title. It's an extinct vintage. We've been hoping, Tom and I, that we would find an old dusty bottle somewhere in a sarcastic cellar. And so far, no luck. But now the new idea is to cook up our own brew and rebrand, restart Yanisey with one of the local distilleries around here.
You should definitely do it. Hey, yeah. Brian, assistant bartender this evening, Chip King, what did they have? Which brewery did they have?
The Horrick Mansion
off Tupun Circle, where the Watergate is now.
That's where the brewery was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the thing to do. Very cool.
Well, the Sims had another tavern that was
right... Is that
how
you say the name? That's your middle name, correct?
S-E-M-M-E-S.
Yeah.
As an admiral.
That was right across from the Treasury down kind of next to the Washington Hotel at F Street and 15th. It was called the Rhodes Tavern. And there was a huge...
It's a very famous
landmark
tavern.
Yeah, yes, it's a landmark preservation fight to preserve the Rhodes Tavern.
Yeah,
it went all
years.
The way to the Supreme Court.
Sure, yeah. For decades they were
And when they finally got the green light, they got in overnight and demolished the whole thing before anyone could file another lawsuit.
Wow, that sounds familiar.
No, that was a big deal. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
The fight over Rhodes,
really
that went on for years in D.C. Yes.
Okay, I couldn't figure out, Tom, what you used to do. Public defender, investigator. I've seen it both ways.
So
you didn't start out saying, "I'm going to write the great American novel."
No. So I came back. I was on the West Coast. Came back here really to go to law school and got a job working for the public defender, and I was doing pre-indictment felony defense investigation. So it's kind of blood still on the sidewalk and stuff. And I did that all the way through law school, my goal was that I was going to become I wanted to be a defense attorney, and
because
Perry Mason,
worst world role models, yeah.
No. I just had kind of it was coming out of the '60s and everything. It was kind of something that was kind of in the groove for me and. But the experience of having spent those years doing criminal defense work and working with this cadre of kind of like young Turks who had just come out of law school, by the time I was getting out of law school, I could see the impact it was having on them. I mean, one of my philosophies in life is that you are what you eat, and that includes the people you surround yourself by. And they had devoured that diet of criminal work and had just become very cynical and... It was all about kind of manipulating the system. And, it's the kind of thing where if you really developed your craft to the highest level, your crowning achievement might be getting a serial killer off on a technicality.
Everybody deserves a defense.
Absolutely. That's
Claude,
the motivating thing.
Claude, to your right there, played, what was his name, Claude? The murderer played.
The serial. In the podcast.
The Mansion Murders. Yeah. Do y'all remember you played the role. Claude, how can you not remember? Remember the Mansion Murders several years ago? Couple and their child and the babies. Right? Horrible.
Circle.
Oh, right. Yeah, right.
There's an incredible podcast called 22 Hours, I believe, and they recreate it. It's interesting. I don't know if it's still this way, but in D.C., they would record the trial and provide a transcript, but there was no video or audio provided. Right. And so to recreate, to do this podcast, they just had the transcript, but they enlisted a couple people to play the roles. And Claude there was the murderer, and he did an excellent job. There you go. Nice.
There you go.
Very well done. Okay. So you thought you'd... Okay, who was the worst you ever defended?
He was the best I ever defended.
Sure.
I love this kid. He was really nicely dressed. He'd gotten popped for riding a stolen motorcycle, but he said, I had my own brand new motorcycle, and I just swapped it out with a friend of mine, and the cops stopped me and not him, and my friend had the stolen motorcycle. I got busted for it. It was like, oh my God, this is great. An innocent client. And I worked my ass off for this kid. And then halfway through, he gets busted in a felony indictment over in Alexandria for robbing a bank because he bought the motorcycle and all the nice clothes with all the money he got from the bank.
Nice.
So he is my favorite client.
Excellent. Okay. So all these experiences give you the... Was writing a novel always just kind of percolating? You thought, I got to do this. I want to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. I think it was. I think I love writing, and I love telling stories. You get that idea? I love telling stories.
Yeah.
And I just one day I just said, you know, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to start writing this, and I started with how I wanted to end it, and then I just wrote to that.
Okay, that's the. Are you a spreadsheet kind of writer? Or are you a seat of the pantser kind of writer?
Well, for this, here's the interesting thing, because I'm going to have to evolve as a writer. For this one, I was definitely seat of the pants. I mean, I created characters who were going to be little minor people who would just flutter past, and then they suddenly became major characters of their own volition, a very organic process. For the next book, which is going to be actually a prequel to this book, it's more of a set piece kind of thing, where you're going into characters who are already created, and I think it's going to be a different kind of challenge for me, because I'm going to have to be figuring out in advance much more.
Who was it? Ken Follett, David, is years ago. Mm-hmm. Ken Follett made it, and he writes, you know, 800,000 page books, and he has this incredibly sophisticated system. It's all digitized to keep track of absolutely everything and keep track of every single character and what they wore, right? Because he doesn't
want...
There are
software programs that you can get where it maps you chapter by chapter by chapter all the way through your book.
Okay. There we go. For all the budding great novelists out there.
It's like one step short of ChatGPT.
Exactly.
You know?
Just barely. Okay, as we say, ostensibly, this is about a couple of guys who are chasing down a serial murderer. But can I read Scott Turow's blurb, which is great? That was a good one. Do you know him?
Kind of.
Okay, it's a good one. Okay. I'm going to read it. I hope I can see this through Rodney's drink. A twisty, well-wrought whodunit set in the Memphis of 60 years ago, driven by savvy characters and the enticing, sometimes lurid, mysteries that always seem to lurk beneath the surface of the Old South. That's pretty good.
Yeah. That's pretty good. That was great.
That's pretty good from Scott Turow. You should just quit now. Forget the other two books. It's not going to be as good as that.
It's going to be hard. Here's how I knew Scott Turow.
Okay.
I get to the point where I'm working with my editor and we finish the last galley, and she turns to me and she says, okay, Tom, now your job is to go out to your vast network of famous authors and get them to blurb your novel.
Flip through that non-existent Rolodex.
Do you hear that pause? That was me talking to my editor. And I started thinking, I started doing this in workmanlike fashion. You know, I developed a spreadsheet of authors that I would just approach cold and everything. And, you know, I actually had some success with that. But then I suddenly remembered, when I was at Stanford, I took a creative writing course, and my TA was Scott Turow.
Wow.
Before he had written anything.
Right. Okay.
And so I just threw a Hail Mary pass out into the cyber world, sent him an email saying, hey, you know, I'm sure you don't remember me. I wouldn't remember me, but I got this novel coming out. I took your class in creative writing. Apparently it paid off. I'd really appreciate it if you could just take a look at it, and if you like it, say a few nice words about it. And he comes back to me, like, and this is the part that, first of all, really surprised me, because usually you get no response. Within an hour, I get an email from him saying, congratulations, Tom, on your book. It's really hard to get published the first time. I don't do blurbs. I just hate picking winners and losers. But in your case, I'm going to make an exception.
Wow. That's
so he
good.
Said, send me the book. No promises. I'll take a look at it. And so I thought, okay, cross fingers. And then right. the next thing I know, my editor's coming back. Having now, I was raised in her estimation significantly. Saying, here's the blurb you just got from Scott Turow.
All right.
He did me a real solid.
Give us the CNN headlines version. Give us the Jamie McIntyre question. What's it about? Without giving away too much.
Oh, gosh. So, okay. So it's about a story of two men. They're both homicide detectives in Memphis. One is a white homicide detective. The other is a kind of a rookie who's been assigned to him almost as a penalty to train. Only the rookie, his name is Eustace, is a there's a lot going on below the surface, and he has his own agenda that he's pushing forward by taking this opportunity. They're chasing a killer who's been reaping revenge on whites in Memphis for years of past lynchings. The whole history in Memphis is quite long, and he has the whole city is in hysterics over this. But that's not all that's going on. There's it was at a point in time, like Memphis in the 1950s is a fascinating time in Memphis and also in the South generally. You know, it was, I think of it as being like a kind of a fulcrum period where you had these established political structures, you know, these kinds of homegrown autocracies, you know, political machines, you know, everyone's heard of Huey Long down in Louisiana. Well, there was a Huey Long in Memphis. His name was Edward Hale Crump. And he basically ran Memphis with an iron fist for four decades. He died in 1954. And my novel takes place 6 months after that, when the power grab is on, everyone's kind of scrambling and kind of trying to figure out, you know, what happened to the big stash of cash that he had accumulated to help kind of run things behind the scenes. And there's a lot of intrigue that's going on. So it was a time in the South generally when you had this crumbling of political structures, but also the nascent beginnings of the whole civil rights movement. And that was starting to happen in Memphis. And then it was also a time when, you know, anyone who's an Elvis lover, you know, that it was a time when there was this confluence of all of these cultural traditions in Memphis, you know, things like blues, R&B, gospel, you know, all of these,
Sun Records.
Yeah, this, all that stuff really came together right in that period in like the mid-50s. So it was just a fascinating time to be there. And I just thought, what a great milieu to write about, you know.
Yeah. Rodney, Child of the South. Have you had a chance to read it yet?
Oh, God, yeah, I've read it three times.
What do you think? And have you asked any big questions yet?
Oh, I was lucky enough to moderate. I played your role. Granted, I was a pale imitation.
You're learning,
Tori, but at a local bookstore a couple of days ago, and it was a standing room only, by the way.
Nice.
And I've read the book and I loved it. And Tom hit the nail on the head. No offense, Tom. You read it, you pick it up. And say, oh, this looks like a nice beach murder mystery. I'm going to read, and then you start reading. You write, this is a lot more than a murder mystery, right? This is a socioeconomic, racial, gender look at a point in time in the South when everything was up for grabs, right? And as Tom alluded to, there were so many undercurrents, and literally the undercurrent of all, the Mississippi River always running in the back of the book, right? And so you just immediately get caught up in this book and the characters, and they're so well drawn, they're so unstereotypical, you know? Mm-hmm. Eustace, the African American, young African American detective, it turns out he's the sort of the old soul in the book.
That's right.
Right? He's the current and that for which so much of the drama runs through. It's just really a terrific book. And And it's hard. It's hard. I have an expression that some of my friends from the South, it's very easy to become a professional Southerner, right? Because all the people always look at us and we're always a little exotic and, you know, we drink bourbon and we go hunting and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
You have a polar bear on your wall.
A polar bear on your wall from your expedition, you know, where you got drunk and shot it back.
Exactly. You didn't really shoot it, but your tour guide shot it for you.
To write a book in which you put all those stereotypes on their head is really hard, you know, but Tom does it magnificently. So that's kudos.
You seem to know a lot about music. Is that a big part of your life?
Well, yeah, yeah.
It's
although
going to be really good in the Netflix series, by the way. The music is going to be fantastic.
If you can get it cleared.
There's almost like a silent soundtrack that runs through the whole thing.
And
that's part of it. It was like that's what was happening in Memphis was music, right? So you can't have that happening and not like see it and feel it all the way through.
Yeah.
I wouldn't consider myself to be a like an expert on the blues or anything. I mean, I know the music that I really love, and it crosses, you know, a wide swath of things all the way from, you know, Dave Brubeck to the Grateful Dead with the blues somewhere in the middle of all that. But growing up in Memphis, it is something that's just there, and you know, you really do grow up with it.
Which of the characters in the book were the hardest to write?
I would say,
and why?
I would say the hardest character to write was the female character, to get right. Because
you aren't one. There's that. Did you bounce it off some of the females in your life?
Damn right. So the best advice I got, and I actually have this in the acknowledgments at the end of it, is like my daughter Isabel, who is a voracious reader. I mean, you know, she reads like 100 books a year kind of thing. And she had read it, and she said, "Dad, it's great. But, you know, it's like, you know, Emmy, you're getting really close to making her a manic pixie dream girl."
Wow.
Which I had never heard.
Does anybody? I have no idea what that is.
I think Manic Pixie Dream Girl opened for Springsteen in '84, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know what that is.
So this is an education, and of course, I immediately like dove. But basically, what a Manic Pixie Dream Girl is, I would call it an affliction of the male writer, who creates female characters who are. They only serve the purpose of advancing the sort of development of the male character, right? So they're two-dimensional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
They don't really have any agency of their own, and it ends up being that kind of thin experience of that character, and it really caused me to go back and to look at her in a different way, and I really extensively rewrote that character to turn her into a much more self-actualized three-dimensional person. And it was successful.
You clearly did a ton of research for this, but doing the research, writing it, did anything surprise you? Did you learn anything about yourself?
Oh, I don't know.
Tom's got family members here. Maybe we should have them come up to the microphone.
Here's the interesting thing about this in terms of like learning about yourself is, and Rodney and I have talked about this, you know, for any guy who has, or woman, who has grown up in the South and left there, there's always that slender thread that ties you back there. It's not, if you grow up in the Midwest or, you know, generic places like that. Okay, I'm from the Midwest, end of conversation. You grow up in the South, and it's like, oh, really? You're from the South? And it's like, there's more of a sense of people identifying you with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I don't really know what it is. I don't know what the answer to the question is. You know, maybe I'll get closer with my next book. But I've clearly got some unfinished business in Memphis that, you know, that drew me there. And it's such a fascinating place to write about that, you know, I'm going to keep digging.
Unfinished business. That's a great line. Okay. Mm-hmm. David, we're going to lose you soon. questions, thoughts?
I'm okay, fine. You're right. I'm fine. My question is this. It's an esoteric question, but I'm always fascinated by Memphis because, unfortunately, it's where Dr. King was murdered. And I just wonder, and I ask this because this is how my mind works. I apologize to everyone listening and everybody here. This is the November 22nd, the anniversary of Kennedy being assassinated in Dallas. And I've talked to so many people, both from Memphis and from Dallas over the years. Like, have you? And the dichotomy is interesting. It seems like the people in Dallas, it's not that they've gotten over it. It's not that they don't remember it. But they put it in sort of a historical context.
It doesn't define them.
Exactly.
Right.
You have to understand what it was like in 1963. We had a rabid right-wing John Birch Society type people running rampant throughout the city. And this guy was a nut. And he kind of glommed onto that. But in Memphis, it's like, no, we're still 50, 60 years later. We're still dealing with this.
Well, I mean, in Memphis, it's like before Dr. King and after Dr. King.
Yeah.
That is like the watershed moment for that city.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there are just really intractable issues around just racial animosity there. But there are also a lot of people who are really trying to break through that.
Yeah.
So, but it's tough because of that kind of thing that, you know, this is an ongoing reference point.
And your book is, well, before then, but
right.
I'm just wondering if that, if it kind of almost echoes back to the writing and kind of like, this is the reality of this city and it always has been.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it was that I had a sense from growing up there that the 50s were a time when actually it was a time of some level of hope in the city because mm-hmm. everything was in motion. Anything was possible, right?
Right.
You know, and when I started thinking about this book, I was really thinking of it as being maybe like one of like a trilogy of books that would really end with Martin Luther King's assassination.
Right. That's good.
Okay. Because it felt like that was
before. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, that's the get you out with this question before we subject you to 60 seconds more, which we have to do, David. We have to make money here on the show.
I know.
We have to make money. It's a trilogy. Did you decide that? Well, I think your publisher expects that, so I'm just...
Well, she is like champing at the bit for the next one. I pitched the next
prequel.
Version of the prequel,
yeah.
And she was like all over that. So let's see
I'm
what happens.
Always, for the record, I am so confused by prequels.
Why?
They just confuse me. Like all the prequels to Star Wars, they confuse me.
Oh my God, no!
But there are 48 of them, Tori. Tom's not going to write.
Tom is only going to do
I'm
three.
The only person that loved the last one with Darth Vader. I thought it was fantastic. That's exactly how we became Darth Vader. Great.
No longer in love with David Aldridge. Okay, so tell us about the trilogy.
Boy, you know, so you ask a question that now I'm going to have to actually think about and decide what my trilogy is going to be in order to answer the question. I mean, here's what happened is I finished this book and I thought, okay, now I'm going to start the next one. I'm going to make a sequel. And I started thinking about what the sequel would be. And I've got some ideas of what that would be. And then I was reading through reading through the characters that I had in the book and what their backstories were. And I said to myself, wait a minute, there's a great novel sitting right there in front of me in their backstories.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what I'm working on now.
Timeline? Which is the worst thing to ask an author. Okay. When's it going to be done?
Yeah, so...
Oh, I thought you meant timeline for the novel. Like,
when no, this is the kind of like barbed question, you know, that your agent or your publisher will ask you. It's like when... And I kind of put a very, very soft stake in the ground. A year from now, because I was telling them, it's like a full-time job marketing this first one.
That's right. That's
you know,
right.
So, sure. But I'm working on it now. I'm actually looking forward to having a hiatus really between now and the rest of the year and to the end of the year to really kind of like get you know, build up a little more momentum. I'm like 20,000 words into it. So,
John Grisham has just a system. It's something when he's writing the book, I think he spends a year writing the book. He gets up in the morning, he has two cups of coffee, he sits down, he works for 3 hours, boom.
I have a system too.
Which
is? On my calendar, every day, I have blocked from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. to work on my novel.
Your writing, yeah.
And then how often do I actually do that? Yeah. Well, the problem for me is that I'm, you know, it's like, you know, I'm running like a fintech company. I'm sitting on several boards. I have like a very active professional life that is really fascinating. And so it's really the challenge for me is really time management. Absolutely. Yeah.
We've heard that from so many people who have day jobs and they say this, you know, trying to do this in the margins of your life is really hard.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we'll be here for the next ones. Okay. Before we do 60 seconds more, any questions from the audience?
Yes, please. Fire away.
Anybody? We can repeat it.
Sorry.
Ruby, literary expert.
Oh, we have
Brooke.
How's it been received in Memphis?
Good. How's it been received in Memphis? Okay. So... I've had a couple of really great articles written about it in Memphis, one in Memphis Magazine and another one in a publication called Choose 901. Memphis area code is 901.
Right.
And like really very good and thoughtful, you know, articles about it. I've had a couple of others, you know, like Publishers Weekly had a nice write-up. It was listed by
New York Times.
Yeah, as like, you know, on their short list of mystery books to buy for Christmas.
Yeah.
Got that? Mystery books to buy for Christmas, everyone?
One of four mystery books to buy for Christmas.
Yes, yeah, so it's one of four. It was a short list, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So, download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
Okay. The book is Midnight in Memphis. Rodney, thank you for making this happen.
That was fantastic.
Thomas Dan,
thank
it's great.
Good.
Congrats.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. Beryl, thank you for being this excellent publicist. It is fabulous. Claude Manny, thank you for doing the important work tonight.
Thank you.
David. Thank you, my friend. Great
always
to see you as ever. Everybody, thank you for listening. We are back in a couple of weeks, and man, we have got to get smart fast because, let's see, Brooke, can you hand me that green book that's on the desk there? A couple of weeks, we come back. This is kind of a hard turn for Midnight in Memphis. Eugenia Chang, who, among other things, has won the LA Times Book Prize. The book is called Unequal, The Math of When Things Do and Don't Add Up. Can I tell you how many times I flunked math? At every level, grade school. Anyways, she's pretty fantastic. So we've got her in a couple
she's
of weeks.
Way smarter than us.
Way smarter, David. We're going to have to study. But everybody, thank you. Go to your favorite independent bookstore and buy Midnight in Memphis. And we're out. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Guests on Chatter on Books are entitled to be entered into a raffle to win a home version of Chatter on Books, which includes a deck of laminated playing cards, a colorful game board, and an hourglass-style timer. Only one entry per person in case of duplicate prizes. Ties will be awarded. Must be present to win.